Good afternoon, and welcome to the session IFRS, Are You Ready for Disruption? Today we've got two speakers, Paul Swinhoe and Peter Baker. Paul's career has spanned working both for life companies and more recently as a consultant. He has taken a great interest in risk insurance throughout his career, and today he'll share with us his experience in looking at the current state of the risk insurance market. Peter works as an actuary at Deloitte and has been in the life insurance industry since 2005. He has extensive knowledge of the Australian life market and has exposure to a number of international reporting environments, including Solvency II. So without further ado, I'd like to invite Paul to speak.
Thanks very much. We had to choose our topic quite some time ago, and we knew the ingredients would be something around IFRS, something around life insurance, and something around disruption. In the end, this is going to be a lot more about disruption, because that we found is far more interesting than IFRS. If you're fascinated with IFRS, then there's a much more deep discussion about it tomorrow. All right. Try an alternative approach. This is not good. That's the arrow down. That's the enter. Click on there. Thank goodness for you. So I'm going to be talking briefly about what's happened recently in life insurance, though that should be pretty familiar to us, so that will not take long. I really want to be talking about what's coming up, and I've put myself through the experience of trying to buy life insurance, and then I'm going to hand over to Peter, who's going to be talking about what we believe are the necessary radical responses from the industry to the situation we're currently in. So I characterise this as the good, the bad and the ugly. The good is that the industry has continued to grow, both individual and group, both at much the same as rates, but it's been achieving 10% compound for quite a long time. You want to be in a market that is growing that sort of quick, at that sort of rate. So it's an attractive market. It's just a matter of being in there on the right terms. That chart on the right shows the profit margins for the industry as a whole, taking quite a dive, particularly brought down in the most recent year by the events in the group market. But it's not all in the group market. When we look at the bad, then we've had rising lapse rates in the individual market, higher claims rates, concerns about claims in disability income in particular, but much more greatly in concerns about claims and higher claims in the group market. Or in a situation where there's substantial competition. Lapses have been an increasing trend in the retail market, and we're seeing that churn has risen substantially, and I don't know that that's ever going to cease. The forces of competition from group market into the individual market, advisors looking to boost their incomes, all puts pressure on the market. And finally, the ugly. It's not often that the life insurance industry makes the front page of the Fin Review, but it did. All right, I admit it was a Saturday, but it was still the front page of the Fin Review, as that little snippet on the right shows. But that is driven by premium deficiencies, by losses, by the amount of money that is has been suffered by shareholders. And so we don't welcome the press coverage, but certainly if that's creating a crisis, we certainly wouldn't want to waste a good crisis. So what's coming up? IFRS is coming, but I will get through this fairly quickly. The major difference that will cause is that the yearly renewable business that we have in Australia will become a one-year contract, and that means we're not going to have large negative policy liabilities where these policies are being treated as assets. The policy liabilities will be at best small and negative. the acquisition of costs that could be deferred in a contract, even if you do change it to being a long-term contract, are lower than they used to be, because it's the direct acquisition costs rather than the associated overheads that the current were allowed to defer. But if it's only 1 year, it's not going to make much difference. I think the impact will be felt in people who use the accounts. Profits will be lower to start with for a business that is continuing to grow because of the lower acquisition cost that can be deferred and not for very long. Obviously, you will catch up because profit is unchanged over time. It's a timing question. But in the first few years of IFRS, if you're in an organisation that's competing for capital, a conglomerate group, some nods in the room, knowing nods, I like that. If you're in an industry business that's competing for capital, then lower profits are not a good position to be in, that you have to explain why you're special and why you're different, and even though your profitability is lower, you still deserve more capital. It's going to make things tougher. Really what I want to talk about is the digital revolution. Technological evolution has transformed quite a number of industries. And you know, we experience that in our day-to-day lives. We're part of that. So my question is, how will life insurance take advantage of digital? Or if they don't take advantage of it, how will you suffer from it? Let's just have a look at a couple of examples of how digital has disrupted other industries. Here you see a closed-down shopping mall, Borders, Blockbuster Video, old businesses that haven't managed to keep up. I love this picture. That big yellow truck, which you can see against a large SUV, doesn't have a driver. Technology has got to the stage where that thing can drive itself, not just on an ordinary road, but down those great circular tracks that get you down to the bottom of a mine where it will fill up and then drive itself back up to the top. The result is that you don't get any complaints from the driver about their radio not working, downtime, productivity loss, and you don't get the gears being cracked, being trashed. So the automatic driver is a better driver than the human driver in many cases. It's been on a journey. You may have heard that to start with they found that female drivers were better than the male drivers because they tended not to crash the gears so much. I don't know about the radio, but the automatic driver is better than them both. So I'll go back. How about insurance? As I said, I put myself through the experience of what it's like to buy life insurance. So the first place I went was to Google, and I put in life insurance into Google. Now, what would you imagine would come up? What insurance companies would you expect to see when Google gives you their first page of answers? Now, if you're working for an insurance company, would you like your insurance company to be appearing on the first page of that? Answer that question to yourself. You can answer it into the microphone later on. And this is what I got. So at the top left-hand side, you got ads. I select Insurance Line and Allianz. And then on the ones that Google presents to you, someone's happy. What are you wearing? That's Zurich is there with an ad. So that they paid for that. The first one that has been cropped up from Google is Allianz, followed by Compare the Market, those meerkat ads that are really irritating, followed by iSelect, followed by NRMA Life. I'm going, I thought AMP bought NRMA Life 10 years ago. That, in fact, is underwritten by TAL. But what you don't see on the front page of Google are the household names are familiar to us, whether they're household names or not, from the insurance industry. And on the right-hand side, you get a lot of advisors and others popping up. So I put myself through the experience. I thought I'd try iSelect. I'd see what went on with iSelect. It was quite easy to get on there. The first thing they ask is for your phone number. They then ask you three fairly strange health questions. Did I ever suffer from sleep apnea? Was the one that took me by surprise. The other two were more standard questions. And then they give me a quote. So here are my quotes. So we are here seeing some names that you might expect to see. And that was the end of it. My phone started ringing. So I then couldn't complete this process by myself. I had to talk to an advisor to go through the health questionnaires or whatever other processes they wanted me to do. So I couldn't complete that online. Because I know who insurance companies are, then I did go to a couple of insurance companies and I could find their online product. But it was hard to find. The websites weren't set up to direct you towards the online application. In fact, the online one was made, at the top you get the products that have got, the XYZ advantage, the XYZ premium, and then down the bottom, if you want to apply online. It was the sort of the least sexy of all of the names that you had there. So I felt discouraged. They really didn't want me to be dealing with them online. With one organisation, I went through the process of having found that. The underwriting questions, really slick. Yes, no answers to lots and lots of things. But it felt pretty good. And just before I had to commit to paying money, then I got out of it. But I felt that was a good experience. So the good experience is there, that I could apply online, I could get a policy. But I had to be someone on the inside who knew where to go to find that. And when we look outside insurance, where do we go when we're looking at buying things or getting more information? And people with a lot less or even no grey hair would much more naturally go online than I do. So if insurance companies aren't coming up on the first page of Google, and if you noticed, I had 950-odd million responses, but I only looked at the first page. If you're not on the first page of Google, you're not there. That's kind of the attitude you'd have. And I would suggest that insurance companies can't afford for too long not being on the front page of Google. That was my experience of trying to buy insurance online. I'm now going to hand over to Peter, who will talk to us about the radical responses that we suggest.
Yeah, thanks, Paul. So I guess, Paul's talked a bit about, I guess, what's happened in the life insurance industry in the past, and I guess what things are coming up in the future that are going to disrupt the market. And I guess our feeling is that, the responses that have been used by the market so far are just eating around the edges of what the issue is. I guess as to anybody who went to the panel session before, I guess there is, going to be structural issues as well as cyclical issues which need to be sorted out. And I suppose these radical responses are more looking at the structural issues in the market. So it's four things I wanted to cover and have a look at today. The first was, going digital. What are insurance companies' digital strategies going to be? Data and how that's going to be used in addressing that. Customer centricity. So I suppose we haven't spent a lot of time going back to basics and thinking what the customers actually really need and what do they want. And also the value chain. Where do the insurance companies really want to play in the market? So to go through those by a bit. So the first of those is digital. So Paul spoke a bit about how difficult it is, at the moment to buy insurance online. We see in other industries, even, for example, the banking industry, where you can go on online and even open an account entirely online. You go to a UBank website and you can open an account, do all your ID checks and everything online these days, as opposed to, 5 years ago where you had to send in certified copies of your driver's license and your passport and things like that. So Deloitte last year actually did a survey on all the key industries in Australia and where they sat in terms of the speed at which digital could be embraced by the industry and also the impact that would have on the industry. So you got those on the two axes that are on this graph on the bottom right-hand corner. So essentially, anything that's short to implement and has a big benefit is going to be is an industry you should be focusing on in terms of digital implementation. So up in the top left, there sits the finance industry, so financial services. So we think that there's, just like there has been big changes in the banking industry, You know, the life insurance industry is something that can follow as well. You know, how come you can't change your cover online, or how come you can't fully do an application or something online with a lot of companies these days? So this has, I guess, a bunch of implications. The first, obviously, well, the first thing that you have to think about is, well, what do the customers want, of course? So, you know, we've got a lot of people using iPad apps, iPhone, and lots of, and even just their computers, whatever, to access services that they need these days. And insurance should be no exception to that. Particularly online access is something that is devoid in this space. Insurers, of course, need to worry a little bit about or consider how that's going to impact on the way that they underwrite their products, what implications that may have for the types of people that are going to, it's going to attract to the product, how easily you can filter out those people you don't really want to have to be picking up insurance. And also they need to understand the privacy issues as well of collecting the data that they are for underwriting and whether that's appropriate for doing online. So I guess in short, for this, for digital, it's going to have a big impact on the market, and it's something that insurers should definitely be thinking about. You know, you don't really want to be in the situation where, say, what you saw in the retail industry where, say, for example, you got companies like Harvey Norman who kind of denied the whole online sales thing for so long that they kind of had troubles once they, you know, once they didn't, they hadn't picked up, you know, the idea of selling online. Other companies came in and filled that gap, and they struggled for a number of years before they picked up that gap themselves. Second of these is the second thing that I wanted to talk about was data itself. So, I mean, yes, people have been using, actuaries have been using data forever. We love data. But what are we going to do to use the data that has, I guess, come to a critical mass over the last few years? So, you know, historically, data has been difficult to collect, difficult to store because of the expense of storage material and the storage capacity, and I guess the expense of computing power itself. The last 5 years have solved that, really. So we're coming to a time now where we have all the data that we want to be able to analyze, and we need to be able to do that faster and faster. We've seen that happen in the stock exchange, in the exchange market industry, where, you know, you've got computers doing computerized trading, making quick quantitative moves on the market to take profits. The other thing that that people have moved towards in other industries is, I guess, the real-time application of data. So, you know, you've got a call center that calls people up or something to sell insurance. Wouldn't you like to know what other things these guys are interested in? What are the products that you could sell to maximise the profit? So what products is a particular customer that you're talking to likely to buy, and which ones are going to maximise the profit for the company? Right? When you consider that there's a bunch of insurers in Australia who are owned by the banks as well, that expands the opportunity even further because you've got a significant data set that you can use to start off with. And I guess as the industry evolves, we'll be able to take advantage of the people who have implemented this in other industries as well. So we're going to move on to the third one, which is, I guess, going back to basics and thinking through, well, what do the customers really need and what they want? So we've listed, I guess, two things that I wanted to think through, which is product design, I guess, and the pricing that's associated with it. So Paul's already talked about some of the changes that are happening in IFRS. That's only one of the things that's impacting the market at the moment. What other things do we need to consider and think about in pricing and the things that we offer our customers? So, you know, you can look at a few of the odd product design features that are in the market at the moment. So you've got the automatic acceptance limits on group that they touched on in the panel debate earlier today. You've got things like TPD and trauma cover, where you can go and get millions of dollars worth of cover. Do people really need that much if they get if they get disabled. And then you've got things like death cover, which goes to age 80 and beyond in some cases. You know, if you, as I said earlier on, I guess you've got, you know, we've got increasing cover over time. You know, as you've paid off your mortgage and your dependents move out of your home and things like that, you don't really need that much cover anymore. And the I guess the product structures at the moment are not really dealing with that properly. Pre-existing conditions, I guess, is another one of those. I guess this comes back to the needs of the customer. You know, often someone can come in and get some cover, not realise they have a pre-existing condition, and essentially be barred from getting that coverage or get that sum assured once they, when they come to actually make that claim. So you've got a situation where someone thinks they're covered for something which they may not be actually covered for. So other ways to change the underwriting procedures so that you could better, cover the needs of the policyholders, but also at the same time, of course, cover the insurer from getting poor adverse claims. On the pricing side then, I guess, to deal with some of that, there need to be a few changes on that. So you spoke before about, Paul spoke before about the changes to IFRS and how that one-year contracts would mean that you wouldn't be able to defer all of your acquisition expenses. So potentially a response to that is to have multiple year guaranteed premiums, almost like, you know, moving to a group market, maybe, where maybe you have a you know, a 3-year guaranteed premium. Maybe that is a better way to go. I'll come back to that one in a little bit. The other one that we've seen is selective lapsation. I suppose Jen Reed did a study a little while back. I think it was earlier this year, actually, on selective lapsation, and noted that I guess they quantified that in their portfolio and saw that there was about a 3% increase in premiums each year due to selective lapsation. You know, we've thought about that as well, and seen that doesn't seem silly, but I guess, you know, each company could do their own analysis of that as well and understand how they're going to incorporate that into pricing. The multi-year guarantees, I suppose, is a relatively straightforward one to price in. There's a few niggly bits about, well, you know, if you're pricing for 2 or 3 years at a time, what is the decrement rate that you're going to use, and how are you going to allow for lapses and things that happen during that period? But I guess it's moving towards that whole level premium idea, just one step at a time. The last thing I wanted to talk about as well was I guess the value chain. So I guess this is something that's been around for a long time, but the changes that have been happening in the market suggest that maybe this is the good time to be reviewing where does the insurer actually want to make money in the market? Where do they want to play? You've got a whole lot of different steps in, I guess, profit pieces in the chain of selling a policy, writing a policy, running it, and where does the insurer really want to participate in the market? So, for example, you've got to move to online and more digital approaches to selling your policies and managing your policies. So, you know, you've got an increase in direct business. Do you actually want to be in that market, or do you not want to be in that market because our profit margins in that component of distribution are going to be higher or lower compared to the past? The same goes for, I guess, ongoing servicing. You got your customer support. You know, is that something you want to outsource rather than to run yourself because of the change in the way the market is working? And, of course, the biggest one being itself, the risk costs and the reinsurance costs. So those are the traditional ones, but something where you could improve your profits potentially by applying things like these data analytics improving the chain of data and information flow between the various steps. So, for example, having your you know, all the information that you've gathered in the underwriting and the sales phase being used to price your policy and also to manage it as you go forward. So I guess, for example, you know, now if insurance if policies are available online, you can sign up for those online. The insurer has information about stuff like how many times has this person come to the website to start the application? You know, is it their first time and they've just gone bang? What's the number? Or is this the sixth time they've come back? In which case, they're probably a little bit more price sensitive to the premiums they're going to get. These are the types of information that can be passed from step to step to make sure that we tailor those policies in the right way. So I think that's all I wanted to say on that. So I suppose, you know, we've been through, I guess, the state of the market over the last few years, what's happened and what's coming up. And I've come up with four different, areas where there may be a need to focus on if you're going to deal with the structural, issues that are currently plaguing the market. So I guess now I'd like to open up.
Thank you, Peter and Paul. That was a very thought-provoking presentation. I'd like to invite the audience to ask questions or perhaps offer your views on what has been put up here for discussion. Certainly, please use the microphone. It's being recorded. And please state your name so we have context as to your comments. And please don't all volunteer at once. We've got 10 minutes, so that could take quite a few 2 minutes comments. So please don't be shy. I can see a lot of insurers in the room, so certainly I would be very interested in your view on whether you agree with the four responses and to what extent is your company or the companies that you're familiar with is focusing on one or more of those responses.
My name's Lewis Lee. I'm work for Score, the reinsurer, based in Hong Kong, actually. I work on the life side, but my background is actually on the GI side. I used to work for Suncorp. Good presentation. The comments you made about digital pricing, online distribution, I mean, on the GI space is second nature. I mean, who buys a car insurance through the advisors? I mean, no one does that. I mean, you go on the website and you compare prices and you buy that. And we did a lot of work on the GI side where, there's just thousands of rating factors and we run pricing engines to make sure that there is a response time that's quick enough such that the information you put on can quickly calculate the premium, not just from a risk sense, but also from your customer demand sense. So we would actually know in real time, you know, if you buy a policy from AAMI or GIO, how much you would, maybe actually charge you at the same time as well. So all that's sort of happening already on the GI space, and that's similar in the UK. And of course, moving over to the life side in the past few years, particularly in Asia as well, I've been amazed, you know, how much of the distribution they still use with agents and brokers in Asia. I mean, it's the same thing with IFAC on the retail space. That hasn't really moved beyond, you know, into the online distribution. And for me, it's actually not that difficult. I mean, there's a lot of rating factors, health factors. You can do a lot of predictive underwriting. The really stumbling block is data privacy because, rating factors is now concerning your life, not just, you know, your lifestyle, not just, you know, your car or your home. So that's one thing, and I think that's going to, you know, might take some changes potentially, and it might be quite sensitive in each market, and you've got different data privacy laws in different countries that I've seen. I think the other thing also, you talk about anti-selective lapses, huge issue in different countries, not just for life insurance, but also for, we'll call it credit illness in Asia, but it's trauma insurance. There's actually a lot of work you can do on the customer elasticity side to actually, you know, apart from, you know, trying to rate your anti-selective lapses in your, you know, retained book, you can actually do work to actually retain the healthy lives or actually improve lives. So we've actually seen a lot of companies now in Asia and also in South Africa that, you know, with wellness programs to actually give you points for discounts if you go to the gym and eat right, and so they'll do a test sort of every year. And that type of stuff actually makes your life healthier, and then you can retain them and also cross-sell other products into them. So that sort of big data sort of philosophy is actually happening. So it just has to, take a few people to, put all those ideas together. And part of it is also the first mover. The big companies, they're sitting on large group books, and, you can't do too much on those. But, it takes a few of those retail players to come in and start thinking about, is there a cheaper way to distribute and a more effective way to underwrite? Subject to the privacy law. So that's not really a question, but it's more of a comment from what I've seen in different industries. Thank you.
Yeah, I was going to say, I guess I was thinking the same thing about why is the take-up in insurance online much faster for GI than it is for life insurance? And I think actually, one of the things is that it's much simpler. People know what they want to get. So I guess you go out and get car insurance in Australia. You know you need to get CTP and you need to get comprehensive car insurance. Well, you don't need to get the second one, but most people will get that. And I suppose in the life market, though, people are not really still aware of what are all the different types of coverage and what are the differences between the different companies and things like that. And I suppose that is probably one of the areas which will slow down the uptake of direct sales and online sales, because I guess until customers really understand what is available, they won't feel comfortable going out and directly getting it themselves, and they'll stay using their advisors.
Thank you, Peter. And thank you, Lewis, for your comment. I'm interested in one of your comment about privacy. And I wonder if anyone wants to comment on that, but I see that Eddie wants to make a comment, so I just want to let Eddie have that opportunity first.
Thanks for the discussion. Well, one of the things you said about Google, if you're not on the first page, you're not on Google. And I'd say with your price comparator websites, if you're not in the top three, you're not going to make the sale. And therefore, one of the reasons I think a lot of insurance companies aren't willing to really go full online is because if you can't guarantee you're going to be in the top three, you might as well not bother. And therefore, why bother, going online? You're better off looking at other sales distributions, things where you can still sell your product, even though it's not the cheapest. I don't know if you've got a thought about that.
My thought about that is how big a threat will be the first one who goes online and does it well.
There's already insurance line, there's Real, there's a couple of there who are already online. Allianz has probably some of the cheapest rates you can get for insurance. Even their advertising on TV says they're 25% cheaper. I think it is. I don't know if there's anyone from Allianz. But what's Allianz's market share? It's not necessarily being the cheapest is going to get you the business, and being first online is not going to get you the business. But if everyone is going online, the only way you're going to be online and sell business is to be the cheapest. And therefore, you're better off spending your money in other distribution angles where you can actually get that value out of the customer.
Well, I agree at the moment not many people are buying online. I think that increasingly, looking at human behaviour, there are an increasing number of people who like to buy online or like to do their research online, and that will be growing. And to deny online is to, put off the inevitable. So I'm trying to, stir up life insurers that if you're not there now, are you sure you don't need to be there tomorrow? Will your alternative, interesting, I'd be calling non-online alternative, will your alternative distribution methods continue to work? And I'm hoping one or two of the insurers in the room might feel inclined to leap to their feet.
John Smith. This issue of why doesn't life insurance sell online comes down to the question of the product itself. How many of us will buy a house online without physically going and visiting the premise and seeing where we're going to stay. When you buy life insurance, you're buying a contract for 20, 30 years that's going to give you coverage. It's not the same as going to a supermarket, a repeat sale, or buying travel insurance online, or buying motor insurance online. And this is where it does have the difficulty that life insurance, particularly if you want income protection, trauma, and other complicated products, you actually need your independent advisor to come in and advise you what it is that you're buying. It's not just the price today, it's the price tomorrow, 5 years' time, 10 years' time. You've got to look at all of those aspects when you're making that decision. It's just like when you buy a house. It's a lifetime decision, and therefore that's what requires advice.
Anyone want to offer an alternative to that? Is it a lifetime decision, given the lapse rate that we've seen?
I think the average house is owned for about 7 years, the average mortgage for about 4 years.
But you don't buy it online.
You said you don't buy it online. I wouldn't suggest that you do buy it online. You can look at it online, and you can reduce the range of places that you go to by looking at them online. You can look at the layout, you can look at the insights. So online is a very natural place to go to research, and I think for a growing number of people it will be a good place to actually achieve fulfillment of their insurance needs. I foresee a lot of changes on getting advice online. I take the view that advice, if I went to half a dozen advisors and told them my situation, I'd hope to get pretty much the same advice, which means that giving advice is open to being put into an expert system rather than something that you need a human to give you. I think the difference a human can make is that they will make me feel good about it, or not, depending on how good they are at their jobs. But the actual advice that I get, I would expect to be really the output of an expert system. I'm trying to lay down the challenge to insurers to say to you that your business model is breaking. You're seeing it in claims. You're seeing it in lapse rates. The cost of distribution is high. I'm not saying that direct isn't costly as well. But it's time to take a really good look at the whole business model and decide where you can play and where you can best be making a profit in an industry that is making much lower profits or even losses than it used to.
Okay, well, maybe we could leave online there, because there are lots of ways to sell insurance. It doesn't need to be online. But I'm intrigued in the use of data and how to use data to sell insurance more effectively and giving our customer a better experience buying insurance and experiencing insurance. I want to pose a question to the audience. I see a lot of bank insurance in the room. Does anyone want to comment on what are the possible privacy issues that is involved with using data that your bank customer give you for the purpose of your of the purpose of their account, and are there any privacy issues there, and how do we deal with it? There are less two in the room. Thank you, Liz.
I'm sure I'm one of the two. I'm Liz Baker. I work at CommInsure. Yes, there are privacy issues. So we're from Commonwealth Bank. So a lot of customers will be with the Commonwealth Bank every time. And I'm also a Westpac customer. I'm very careful now what I use my card for. Right? Because every time you use your card, every time I go out, the bank knows what you're buying if you pay with the card. Every time you use SPOS, what you bought, whatever. Right? And all of that transactions is possible, not with your name on it, but together would be possible to use, and it's very good rating factors. So there are certainly privacy concerns. I think our bank's quite conservative about what we use. We don't use any lifestyle data. I think it's a growing challenge. And I would agree, direct, it's not cheap either. It's a different type of cost. You need a lot of IT. You need a lot of... Yeah, you need a lot of smart people as well, and it's not easy. There's a lot of investment, so I think I'm interested in the YRT that's no DAC. You know, that's going to be challenging, you know, because there's still a lot of acquisition costs on data. So, but it's interesting. There's a lot of data, and I think our bank, we use data to target what we might think is a better risk pool. That's one. And we're also look at, separate to that, is the propensity to buy. So, you know, how do you match a model with propensity to buy versus the good risk? And I'm sure other institutions are also working on that. But I mean, we come from a company where we've got everything. We've got direct, we've got group, we've got retail, we've got superannuation investments. So you have to, it's good to be diversified, but there's sort of channel conflict as well, and you have to be quite wary of that. And also simplicity of product. It's one thing to buy it online. I mean, the products that we sell direct, it's much more simpler in the definitions. So yeah.
Any other comment on that topic? Paul and your Paul and Peter, in your presentation you mentioned four kind of responses. Where do you see the industry responses focusing on, and are we doing well, particularly well, in any of those?
Okay, sure. So I think the uptake of digital has probably been the biggest thing that we've seen across other industries. Certainly not, but not yet in life insurance. So I think at this point, data has been the biggest one that companies have been looking at, just because, I guess, well, a lot of it has been driven by the actuaries, and we love data, so it's just getting to a point now where we have enough data to start, putting together a meaningful analysis to use for the business. So, I guess as an example, I've done a bunch of different projects in the past around retention. Actually, surprisingly not in life insurance, but rather on the banking space, where you can pull together information about what customers have done over the last 2 years, and maybe you have that data every month, and you can essentially map out on two axes, you know, what is the likelihood of someone leaving, you know, the propensity of someone to leave versus the value that they bring to the company. So I guess in a life insurance sense, that would be the EV value that they contribute. And essentially you can then put together a matrix of that and target people that have a high likelihood of leaving and have a high value to the firm, and, you know, bring them up and offer them a discount on their home loan, or offer them a voucher to a spa or something like that to encourage them to stay. And obviously that's just a very simplistic way that you can use data, but those are the types of things I think that are going to grow going forwards, particularly in life insurance as well. I think one of the difficult bits at the moment is getting that value right down to the customer level. That's not quite there in the life insurance space yet, but it's getting there. Yeah.
I might add to that. I mean, I liked what Liz had to say about using data for targeting and targeting and propensity to buy. In the US, data is also being used in the underwriting process, not to make the underwriting decision, but to decide whether someone is the sort of person who's worth sending for another test or not. I think once you start using it underwriting in pricing, you're into dangerous waters at the moment. But certainly whether or not it's worth the cost of sending them for another test is something that data can help inform.
Are there any last-minute questions from the audience? I want to make a comment about the IFRS impact and the fact that there is less scope for deferring acquisition costs in the future. When it first came in, when the standard was being developed, it was thought that not being able to defer acquisition costs might change behaviour, and I was just interested in this audience's view on that. Do you think the fact that you won't be able to defer as much, will it change will it change behaviour? Would we turn to writing business with less upfront cost? Maybe if I get the straw poll, who thinks it will? No one thinks it will. Oh, one. One person. Four. I've got four. Who thinks it won't?
There's only one here, so.
Oh, and the rest doesn't have an opinion. So four to about ten, do you think? Four to ten that it will change, and the ten say no, it won't change. Very interesting. Do you have any questions for the author who asked the provocative questions? If there is no more questions, I'd like to thank the authors and invite you to do the same in the usual way.